Welcome to Thoughts on Record, official podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Each episode, we explore topics of interest to clinicians and mental health consumers from a cognitive behavioral perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Pete Kelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Andrea Oshbaugh is an associate professor in the School of Psychology at the University of Ottawa, director of the Center for Psychological Services and Research, and is a licensed clinical psychologist in the province of Ontario, Canada. She obtained her master's and PhD in clinical psychology from Concordia University in Montreal, Canada, and completed a postdoctoral fellowship in the Department of Psychiatry at McGill University and the Douglas Mental Health University Institute in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. She is the director of the Cognition and Anxiety Studies Laboratory and the Sex and Anxiety Research Group. Her research interests center around understanding the causes of and developing treatments for anxiety and fear-related problems. She has recently started a program of research to understand the causes and psychological effects of experiencing traumatic and non-traumatic events that transgress one's moral beliefs in military personnel and veterans. Dr. Oshbaugh regularly supervises CBT training and teaches courses on psychopathology and clinical psychology at both the graduate and undergraduate level. She has served on the editorial boards of Psychological Assessment. She is currently an associate editor for the Journal of Behavior Therapy and Experimental Psychiatry, as well as an editorial board member for Behavior Research and Therapy. She is a former president of the Canadian Association for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies and was seminal in the development of the National CBT Training Guidelines that were released by CACBT in May 2019. All right, Dr. Andrea Oshbaugh, welcome back to Thoughts on Record. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. How are you?
I am very well, thanks. Well, today's topic is one of my favorites. I'm going to loosely call this, I guess, issues related to the conceptualization, development, and implementation of diagnostic frameworks around mental illness. I almost always leave these kind of conversations with more questions than answers, but I think this topic pulls in so many interesting threads and has a lot of huge implications, both at the systems level as well as that of the individual. So thanks for taking the time to hopefully have a really interesting discussion today.
My pleasure too. I love talking about diagnostic issues. So this is right up my alley.
Excellent. I guess with that, I'm going to start us off with a fairly big discussion point or question with the caveat that probably neither of us has the definitive answer, I'm guessing. But it's this, you know, I guess the age old question of what is mental illness anyway? And I wanted to frame up the discussion with a recent tweet that I saw from Alan Francis. He's one of the, I believe he chaired the commission that put together DSM-IV. Yeah. And he's written a very interesting book called Saving Normal, where he's had a lot of strong critiques of the DSM framework. He also makes the point about its utility as well, but he has raised some pretty interesting concerns. Anyway, he had this tweet where he basically said, major depressive disorder is DSM's biggest mistake for the following reasons. Number one, it's too broad. It lumps severe endogenous depression with mild reactive depression. Number two, it confuses grief with clinical depression. Number three, it turns normal sadness into a mental disorder. Number four, it encourages excessive med use. And that might be an issue that we talk about, sort of the interplay between these diagnostic systems and pharma and primary care. And then number five, often not major, often not depressive, and often not a disorder. So I guess sort of in summary. So Andrew, what do you think about this notion of mental illness? What is it? How do we think about it? How do we think about it relative to diagnostic frameworks? What comes up for you if somebody asks you, hey, what is a mental illness?
I mean, I suppose it all comes down to that age-old idea of, you know, a lot of the mental illnesses that I focus on, first of all, are emotional in nature. So I'll focus on the emotion. But, you know, for me, I guess mental illness comes down to, do the emotions that I experience and my ability to cope with those emotions cause me recurrent problems in my day-to-day life? And as you can see, as I was trying to define how I define mental illness, I had to pause there a couple times because I really need to think about that. Because, you know, when we think about emotional functioning, of course, there's moments where we experience emotions and they do cause us stumbling blocks, but we wouldn't want to label those stumbling blocks like grief and things like that as mental illness. So, you know, I think that all these diagnostic systems, we will probably get into it, but there's definite utility and value to them. But I think our challenge has been, it's such a complex phenomena that we're trying to simplify, that it becomes really challenging.
No, absolutely. I get wrapped around the axle in exactly the same way. You know, I've had many clients over the years who have gone through some very, very difficult challenges, and I would say have very strong emotional reactions, which are quite disruptive to their life, maybe even to their functioning in the short term, but in some ways have been absolutely necessary, right? I think there is something about the information that you can download from a strong emotional experience that gives you really good information in many cases about what's going on. And again, it's not always functional. I think there's times where it becomes dysfunctional, but I think we have to be very careful, like you're saying, about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, where we label emotions as good or bad, as opposed to maybe pleasant versus unpleasant. They all have a purpose ultimately at the end of the day.
I spend lots of time working with my clients talking about how bad emotions are helpful, so are unpleasant emotions, but they often label them as bad. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Andrea, when you're speaking with your clients, how do you think through, you know, maybe what sort of more pathological or dysfunctional versus normal and expected reactions to normal life? Like if someone's going through, say, unemployment or the dissolution of a romantic relationship, I mean, personally, as a human being, I would expect very strong emotions to surface around that. The bar would be set extremely high for me to start to consider reactions being in the domain of a mental illness around that. How do you think through it? What are your lines in the sand if you have them?
You know, I suppose, you know, I still use diagnostic classification systems. So, you know, I think that idea of having a very thorough assessment to understand what's going on in the person's life, what's prompted them to come here, and what are the symptoms that they're experiencing. But I'm also, you know, I'm also very careful when I'm working with clients, you know, if they're going through a divorce and they're meeting criteria for major depressive disorder, I might tell them, you know, you're meeting criteria for that. But a lot of this is related to, you know, what you're going through, and some of these negative emotions that you're experiencing are perfectly normative. So I would probably pass along that message. We've talked about this in the last podcast that we did together, is talking about sort of these beliefs about emotions. So I think that that does play a role in this too, in that, you know, the messages that people get about mental illness and the messages that they get about what a healthy person's supposed to look like and supposed to be doing, I think, you know, sets people up to be overly concerned when they're having normative struggles and just need to cope through it.
Yeah, those perceptions or beliefs, you know, seem to be on some level culturally bound, right? Where I think there's an expectation, certainly amongst North Americans or Westerners, if I can use a very broad blanket term, the expectation around the amount of pain that we're going to experience is very different than it might be in some other cultures. I feel like I might have cited this stat last time that we chatted, but I believe that North Americans consume the vast, vast majority of painkillers. Again, I think it's worth drawing a distinction between pain that's in the service of growth versus, I do think that there is psychological pain that's just really suffering.
Yep.
It's got no good, you know, sort of reason behind it. It's just plain old suffering. And there, I think it brings in interesting conversations about, hey, is it time for medication or, you know, other things that might, ECT or other things that might be available. But I do sometimes see that we have folks who are, it's crossed the threshold of something to learn, and they are just straight up suffering with a lot of distress and psychological pain.
Yeah. You know, I think the other challenge is partly that as psychologists, we're really trained, you know, and I think it's a good thing, trained to be able to detect those problems, right? We're trained to be able to detect mental illness and to sort of think like, this is what we're teaching. And this is what we're supposed to be helping with. So we've kind of had that on the radar. And I think sometimes we have to remind ourselves that, you know, sometimes the people who are coming to us, really, they just need that support, right? So they might need sort of that extra support to find additional coping strategies or to be reminded how to use those coping strategies when they're going through a difficult time. So I think that there's also that piece on our end too. It's not just a cultural piece, but I agree that that culture part, especially sort of that North American culture, you kind of have to suck it up and get on with life. And that taking that time and allowing yourself to feel those negative emotions is healthy and adaptive. I absolutely do think that that plays a big role in North Americans' conceptualization of mental illness and our love of antidepressants.
No, absolutely. No, there does seem to be sort of a sub, I'm not even sure if it's a subculture, but of purveyors of sort of radical self-reliance, right? Where it's sort of, you just keep persevering no matter what to the exclusion of any internal difficulty. And I think a lot gets missed in that. Like, I'm all for resilience. I don't think anyone's anti-resilience. But I do think part of being resilient is being able to tolerate and connect with one's internal experience.
Absolutely. You know, and I think that's a key part. And I really think that I do think the culture is changing, and sometimes maybe it's even flipping to the opposite end. But I think there's really this idea, you know, that this idea that, you know, you're supposed to like muddle through these emotions and get on with it and not take the time to rest is it's a strong message that we get in our culture.
So, Andrea, a question I have for you is, you know, I think there is a role for diagnosis, like as we're going to talk about, I think shortly, there are challenges with the diagnostic frameworks that we use. But in day-to-day clinical practice, I do believe they have a utility. And certainly I can speak to some of the things that I've noticed around that. I also want to talk about the experience of communicating a diagnosis to clients and some of the dynamics that I've noticed around that. From your lens as a clinician, what is the potential utility of a diagnostic framework and communicating a diagnosis to a client? What have you seen in your experience from that perspective?
Lots of questions there. I think that the idea of having some sort of diagnostic system to classify the people that are coming to us is useful, you know, in terms of just giving us a general framework or a general idea of what we need to be focusing on in treatment. So it's helpful for me to know, like, this person is coming to me because of symptoms of social anxiety disorder, as opposed to coming to me with symptoms of major depressive disorder. It helps give me a framework. I think in terms of it also gives me a framework to be able to talk with or consult with colleagues about challenging cases. As an academic, it also gives me a framework to be able to study this phenomenon. I can't, you know, particularly from the perspective of just being able to communicate with other professionals, I think that it's nearly impossible not to get away from some sort of classification system. The utility of having an official system is that we'll all kind of be speaking the same language instead of using our own metric. I think my experience in terms of working with clients, a lot of the times people, if they do have a mental diagnosis, a mental disorder, I think there's a lot of relief from being able to put a label and to sort of say, you know, this is what the problem is. And also the inverse, right? To be able to sort of say, you know, you are experiencing these negative emotions, but actually you're coping quite well, or actually this is what to expect. And, you know, this isn't a mental disorder because of all these different factors that are going on in your life, you know, and here's what I can do to sort of help you learn to manage that a little bit better. I also think that can be really relieving for clients. The other challenge that comes, well, on the downside, when there's disagreement across professionals about what the nature of a problem is for an individual, that can also end up being incredibly confusing for them as well. So, I mean, there's pros and cons in terms of conveying that information to a client. I don't know what your experience was like.
I've had the exact same experience that you've described, where I think sometimes it's provided a great sense of relief for clients. I think there's other times where it's led to additional confusion, especially if they've heard other diagnoses conveyed by other professionals. I think there's also too the possibility of stigmatization. There's certain diagnoses like borderline personality disorder that once they show up in somebody's chart, they tend to sort of follow that person around, and especially in a public health setting where there might be more information shared. Someone shows up in the emergency room, there might be sort of an eye rolling reaction potentially, when really that person's in intense distress and needs a certain kind of help in that particular moment. They don't need an eye roll.
Yeah.
So there's that. I've also seen an interesting evolution of expectations around diagnoses as well. For instance, I do a lot of ADHD assessments, and there seems to be something about that diagnosis where people are very strongly attached to it coming in. They want the validation for their experience. And we know that ADHD is one of the most overdiagnosed conditions. So I do tend to put the bar, I wouldn't say overly high, but I put it high enough so that I'm ensuring that I'm diagnosing something real and not sort of noise, let's say. And what I found is that, let's say somebody, I'll make up a scenario. They meet diagnostic criteria for three of the possible symptoms for inattention when you really need five. There's not super strong evidence in childhood, maybe some, but there's certainly stuff going on in day-to-day life. What I'll communicate to the client is, like, I absolutely believe that you are being impacted by significant symptoms of attention and concentration in your day-to-day life. They're not commensurate with what we would call ADHD, but nevertheless, I would just want you to feel really validated in the sense that you are having challenges and your treatment recommendations are going to reflect that. The number of times I've seen people be so crestfallen to not have that diagnosis, and they're saying, like, I really hope this would explain what's going on. I'm like, it does. It's just, and then you have to get into that whole interesting discussion of the dimensional conceptualization of mental illness, where, say, zero is no symptoms, 10 is maximum symptoms. We've arbitrarily put a line somewhere where we say, if you're above the line, you have it. If you're below the line, you don't. But in reality, of course, everyone sits on a dimension. These are differences of degree, not kind. So anyway, I think it's hard for the lay public to understand the artificial slicing and dicing of these things into zeros or ones, when really the experience of everybody is that they're somewhere on a continuum.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think that's a really, you know, I think it's a really important point to remember. I think, you know, it's only, you know, when you enter clinical psychology graduate school, or maybe if you were lucky enough to take an undergrad psychopathology course, where you might get some sort of inkling of an idea that these are really man-made constructs that we've developed, right? But if you're looking at anything, you know, anything on the internet, Facebook, or any, you know, any of these wellness websites, or even advertisements for pharmaceuticals, right? They talk about them as if they are actual things, right? And the actual things in the unofficial public system, such as, say, high functional anxiety. What's that? Or again, the idea of narcissism. Everybody seems to have narcissism these days on many of these websites. I forget where I'm going with this again. Sorry. But I think that the public really gets this idea, essentially, that they're actual things, and we know they're not actual things. So I think when we come to somebody and say, well, you've got these symptoms of ADHD, but they're, you know, and while they're just troubling for you, they're not quite enough to actually warrant a diagnosis. It can get really confusing for them.
Yeah, such a great point. These are constructs which we have imposed upon collections of symptoms. It's not like you can do a blood test or an X-ray at the moment, or even an imaging study, and say, ah, yes, the images come back, you have major depressive disorder. Or it's not like cystic fibrosis, where, say, there's a mutation in a very specific gene, and we know we can call that a disease. There's a very identified pathology. There are so many roads to get to depression. Again, it's a syndrome. It's a collection of symptoms of which we have arbitrarily decided that this number and this intensity of symptoms will comprise the mental illness. So it's
and this length of time of having those symptoms too.
Right. Two weeks. Those magical 2 weeks, right? Who made that up, right?
Yeah. I've always wondered that actually. Where did the 2 weeks come from? Like 2 weeks actually seems like a very short period of time when I think about the, like going through a depressive episode, say following a breakup or anything like that.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out, people may not be aware of this. And again, Alan Francis has given this a really nice treatment in his book, Saving Normal, where the DSM platform is really been put together by expert consensus. It's been partially research driven, but not as research driven as it could be. And it makes you wonder, I'm being a little bit facetious here, but like, it makes you wonder if someone went out and had Quiznos for lunch versus had a plain hen sandwich and was in a better or worse mood in the afternoon and came back, like, would it have been 3 weeks versus 1 week versus a month? Like, it's all just sort of arbitrary and a little bit made up. I mean, I think that for people who are not within the system, that might strike them as unbelievable, but that is the reality. So again, when I'm explaining this to clients, it's like, I'm not conveying to you something set in stone that is like some gospel truth according to the universe. This is the framework we have. This is, you know, it's a tool that we use. It's not an eternal truth. It's much more important what your actual experience as a human being is.
Yeah. I mean, I suspect, like, if we go back to that 2 weeks, and I know this is in the discussion just about the diagnostic system of depression, but, you know, you could imagine that, you know, somebody who's experiencing really intense suicidal ideation and spending all their time thinking that they'd be better off dead and lying in bed for 2 weeks, you know, that absolutely sounds like something that warrants help and probably a diagnosis. But on the other hand, we have many individuals who don't look like that, you know, where they might be feeling down and depressed. They have a loss of interest, but they're able to go to work. But, you know, they're not getting much pleasure from life. They're having difficulty concentrating. They're tired all the time, but they're kind of fumbling through for 2 weeks. They would also meet a criteria for depression, but that could very easily lift, you know, and it would be just a sort of little 2 week little blip. But I think like that distinction, I mean, I think that highlights, you know, we're trying to be very consistent in how we apply things, but it's so difficult to try to capture a label of major depressive disorder that reflects people who really need to have that diagnosis in a short period of time versus people who maybe if you let them, you know, sort of wait it out for a bit longer might recover.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And again, Alan Francis talks a lot about sort of just like a watch and wait approach. Take a longitudinal view of the client and see what evolves. And many, if not most things are going to tuck themselves away by themselves. And if it continues to persist at that severe level, then there's perhaps something going on. Another thought I had while you were chatting was just about the diversity of presentation. I forget what the number of diagnostic criteria to be met for borderline personality disorder is, but I believe if you do the math and look at all the permutations, there can be like 256 versions or something of borderline personality disorder, depending on how you mix and match the different symptoms together, you know, depending on the particular individual.
PTSD is the same and it's worse. I think there's a paper that's called like, you know, 1,600,000 different ways to have meet criteria for PTSD or wow, something like that. But it's the same thing. There's a lot of different permutations of these different kinds of problems. So I think in the case of borderline personality disorder, you can have two people who have no overlapping symptoms whatsoever, but both meet criteria for borderline personality disorder. You know, the personality disorders in particular are a really challenging, mucky portion of the diagnostic system. And I think that's the exact reason why they didn't touch it when they went from the DSM-4 to DSM-5, because they just didn't know what to do with it. But yeah, I agree. Like, I'm not quite sure. I really do think that some of these more dimensional models, while more complex possibly, I think are probably a better reflection of the state of what mental illness might be.
Absolutely. Something, a question that came up for me, and I meant to ask you a second ago, I'm going to pick your brain on it. I've often seen clients with ADHD or depression as well, where they would meet all the diagnostic criteria, but when we look at functioning, we see that they're hyper-conscientious, people pleasers, unrelenting standards, and they're able to power through the symptoms. And it's causing its own problem, of course, like they might be getting burnt out or they're kind of white knuckling through their day. I feel like on some level, those clients end up being penalized for being really good copers, you know, in some strange way where they have a lot of things going on that are really quite distressing, but their ability to adapt is also so high that we wouldn't call them depressed or having ADHD, but there's a lot going on. And I never know what to do with that. I mean, if you go by the book, you know, you go by impact on functioning, but people's ability to function is not created equal. So what do we do with this? And again, I'm not asking for the ultimate answer. I'm just kind of curious how you think through that conundrum where people are able to, especially I'm thinking at the extremes, where people are really able to power through what they shouldn't actually be able to be able to power through on some level.
Well, first, I would argue that if they're actually getting burnt out, then there is an impact on function.
Right, right.
So, you know, if they're needing to take time off work because they're so wiped out because they're just go, 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 like that is how I would characterize that, even though they're high functioning most of the time, because they're having to put so much effort into it. You know, they have to, it's impacting their ability to do work. But, you know, for those other individuals, you know, I think the important part to remember is there's the distress and dysfunction piece, right? And you don't actually need both, or you can have one or the other. So I think, you know, if a person's able to recognize, like, I'm feeling anxious all the time, I can get what I need to get done, but, you know, I'm really struggling because, you know, I'm on edge all the time. I think there's the distress part there. And quite likely, if you dug a little bit more, you might find that, you know, they're having trouble sleeping, or it might be impacting social functioning because they can't take a day off and those sorts of things as well.
Yeah, those are great points. I mean, I often say to a lot of my first responder clients, like, just because you can deal with this doesn't mean that you should be, especially given exactly what you've just said, the day-to-day distress, like the price of admission to continue in day-to-day life with that level of engagement is often just completely unsustainable. So absolutely, the in-the-moment coping looks okay, but the ultimate outcome here is the person ends off work or burnt out or any of those things for sure.
Yeah, I suppose the trick is, you know, in a perfect world, we would want to be able to identify that before they have to go off work, before they're distressed, or before the dysfunction becomes apparent, I suppose. You know, so I, you know, if somebody's coming in and they're distressed and they're not happy with what they're doing, or they're reporting a lot of worries, even though they're getting really good feedback at work, I think, you know, likely that distress piece is probably a good reflection. A nice example is somebody who like fantastic, you know, work performance feedback, but then there's always this need to sort of top it. And there's this pressure where they're like, you know, well, now that I've gotten this good feedback, I need to do even better. Right. And they're able to do it, but they're doing it under such duress because they have this high need to perform and to get that positive feedback.
Yes. The old unrelenting standards, hypercriticalness, core belief schema.
Yes. That one.
Yes. Not a stranger to many healthcare providers in my experience, unfortunately.
It's true. Psychologists too. We're included in there.
Oh, grad school almost rewards you for having that core belief system, right? Yeah. It's like, hey, just get through the next 6 or 7 years and we don't really care what happens to you after, but as long as you can get through and perform at a high level, then congratulations to you.
Yeah. Yep.
It feels like a good time to introduce maybe some of the platforms that we've been alluding to in the conversation. We've talked about DSM. DSM might be the one that most shows up, I think, it's maybe in the media, so on and so forth. There's also the ICD system, which I believe is by the WHO or the World Health Organization.
Yep.
I believe that is not just mental illness. I believe it's a general diagnostic framework for many, many types of diseases, other forms of physical illness as well. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. So it covers all mental illness. So I think it's chapter 5 is the mental and behavioral disorders. And really, you know, it developed out of, you know, through the World Health Organization as a way of collecting statistics, essentially. It started about collecting statistics about mortality originally, so reasons why people died, and then it was reasons why it was mortality and morbidity. And so it's essentially a system that's used by the entire world for the World Health Organization to collect information about the kinds of problems that people are facing globally.
Right. And I believe the ICD essentially uses the same kind of categorical approach that the DSM does, correct?
Mostly, but not as sort of rigidly. So DSM is really like sort of a categorical system. You need to receive, you need to meet 5 of these criteria, 5 of these 9 criteria to meet criteria for depression. And while they do have sort of that criteria kind of approach, the ICD is a little bit more like a prototype approach, in that they will sort of describe what a typical person with depression might look like. What are the signs and symptoms? But, I haven't used it extensively, but, you know, it's sort of more like, this is what the picture looks like. You know, your person needs to, sometimes it might be the person needs to have like these 2 things. But it's less in terms of meeting a number and more in terms of meeting a picture, I suppose, for the ICD. But there's a lot of overlap. So you know, in fact, if you look in the DSM, the codes that they provide are all converted between ICD and DSM, and that's essentially so that because the DSM, if you know. Is really the North American system. It's put out by the American Psychiatric Association. So it's really the system used in North America. But in the hospital systems there and things like, and here as well, when they send their information to the World Health Organization or when those statistics are compiled, they need the codes for the ICD. So that's why you have those ICD codes in the DSM. So there's a lot of overlap between the two, but the conceptualization and the way that they think about it is slightly different.
Andrea, are there any other interesting diagnostic systems on the horizon that have come onto your radar? I know I've seen a few floating around. I haven't looked too far into them just because day to day I'm so steeped in the traditional ones that it's been hard for me to onboard too much more than that. But what's coming onto your radar from a diagnostic lens?
Okay. So, well, the two alternative diagnostic systems that really come up for me is something called the HITOP. And now I'm going to get put on the spot to try to remember what it stands for. The Hierarchical Taxonomy of Psychopathology
there
is
we go.
The term. And then there's one that's less diagnostic in nature, but more focused on a system to get away from the DSM when we're conducting research on mental illness. And that's the research domain criteria developed by NIMH. So those are the two that, and they're both, you know, neither are particularly used broadly at this point in time. HITOP is very new. It's put together a lot, it's been put together by a lot of mental health clinicians, but it sort of builds some of these hierarchical models. I think Achenbach, who is responsible for the ASEBA and the CBCL, which are measures that we use all the time in our clinical practice, they were involved in it. It sort of builds upon Clark and Watson's tripartite model, but it's really the idea that, you know, you can, you know, that there's sort of these broader, higher order dimensions of mental illness, and then you can break down sort of them into smaller categories. So, you know, when, you know, and to some extent, I think the child and family folks have it, they speak a lot about, you know, internalizing versus externalizing problems and stuff. And I think they've got almost a more advanced system sort of a categorical or dimensional system to think about mental illness when you talk about child and family. So they often talk about internalizing versus externalizing problems in the context of working with their clients. And that's where sort of high top kind of starts. And then they have one extra little hierarchy, which is sort of thought disorders, which is disorders in thinking specifically. So these would fit in with, some of the magical thinking or bizarre thinking, the hallucinations and stuff that you might see in schizophrenia. On the other hand, the internalizing, these are symptoms associated with distress. So these are your anxiety, depression. They also link eating pathology. So symptoms associated with eating disorders and also symptoms associated with sexual problems under the internalizing umbrella. And then you've got the externalizing, which are, the excess problems, so to speak. So this is substance abuse, antisocial behavior, so conduct disorder, acting out and things like that. Sort of the impulsivity and disinhibition that you might in difficulties in attention and things like that, that you might get ADHD. But the idea is really that you're not saying you meet or don't meet for any of these things. It's not that you have an internalizing problem or you don't. The idea is that everybody's got some of both, and you're talking about sort of levels and sort of the focus of distress. So you might describe somebody as high internalizing with a specific focus on fears related to social situations and levels of distress associated with worry, for example. So you're really trying to get away from saying like, this is the label that you've got, into sort of just describing some of the major characteristics of the individual that might be impacting their functioning. That's the reason why I really like it. And the model was really developed using factor analysis. So it was really taking like all these different measures and sort of plunking them in a model to sort of understand how these factors all relate to each other. So it was really built from statistical model upwards as opposed to downwards.
Yeah, it's a really important distinction for something like DSM that, again, is kind of more expert consensus driven than, again, sort of like having a whole pool of data and then, through factor analysis, deciding how things clump together statistically and having a more of a data driven approach. So it seems like this high top approach would generate almost more of a profile, almost something like you'd find with a big five personality inventory, where you're not like, you would never say someone does not exist on a dimension of introversion or extroversion. They are somewhere on that continuum. Like, I really like that everybody's going to fall somewhere on one of the dimensions that is outlined in this model. So I've understood that correctly then.
Yeah, that's how I understand it. Now, I've never used the system. I've taught about the system. I've read about the system. I found it, and it really is new. So I think it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago that some of the first papers started coming out about the system. It reminds me a little bit. So at the back of the DSM, they have the dimensional perspective on personality disorders. So it's a little bit like that, where, instead of saying somebody's depressed, you're talking about like what levels are higher for them versus lower for them and what might be impacting them. So I think it's, it's probably, it's certainly not ready at this point in time to be, disseminated broadly, but I think it's one to keep an eye on to see what, how it plays out. But I think that it, particularly when we're working at, providing psychotherapy for a client, I think some of these sort of dimensional models might be very helpful for us in terms of how we conceptualize clients and help them.
No, I totally agree. And I can't remember if I heard this at a grand rounds once or whether I read it in a paper. But basically the idea was that if, say, you have the grandmother has OCD, the mother has social anxiety disorder, and the daughter has panic disorder of some kind, The interesting thing is that the compound from a medication perspective that will work the best for each one of them is oftentimes ends up being the same. Speaking to the idea that there is a common underlying genetic disposition that runs through all these different disorders. It's manifesting different in grandma, it's manifesting different in mom, it's manifesting different in daughter, but ultimately at the end of the day, there's something that binds them all together, and there's not a lot of utility perhaps in separating them out into these artificially designated categories. There's something that binds them together. So anyway, I just had that little finding come up in my mind as you were talking about that, and I do think maybe that maps onto what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think it does map on. And, you know, as you're talking about that, like I'm thinking to myself, you know, my expertise is in anxiety disorder, so I'll speak about that. But when I think about treating people with cognitive behavior therapy with anxiety for anxiety disorders, often the conceptualization is very similar. What differs is, you know, the basic model is the same for everybody. What differs is like the focus, the little pieces that I put in that box that to show what the cycle is, you know. And so, you know, one of my favorite protocols to work from is Barlow's transdiagnostic approach. I get a lot of positive effect out of that model. And I think it works really well with clients who come in with it sort of a mixed bag of things. And so I think there was something spot on about that model and that way of conceptualization. And I think that it fits very well with this sort of dimensional perspective to sort of thinking about, you know, what are the things that are high and low? What are the things that are problematic for you?
Absolutely. I was literally going to ask you if that's a model that you are a fan of and if you use. I certainly likewise have had really good success with it. I love the simplicity of it. And I feel like part of the secret sauce of that protocol is the emphasis on safety behaviors.
Yep.
And by making behavioral changes, you can get a lot of great new data flowing in, which will change cognitions and all that kind of stuff. It, also, from a private practitioner lens, you often see clients that come in where there's a little bit of social anxiety, but not diagnostic. There's a little bit of panic, but not panic disorder. There's a little bit of GAD, but it's not quite GAD. And that might all be within the same client. And so you've got this kind of omnibus, all-in-one common thread strategy that will really resonate with the client, where they're like, okay, it doesn't matter really what the anxiety is about. Here's the general strategy for addressing that.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, and that's my experience as well when I've been working with clients privately, but even through our community mental health clinic, that really ends up being what it looks like.
I think it brings up the question of these diagnostic systems. Well, it sounds like HITOP might do a much better job of incorporating this, but one thing that's really tough within a DSM or an ICD framework is handling comorbidity,
at
least from a conceptual point of view, right? Is depression with PTSD the same as depression on its own? We don't really know, right? They might be different at a brain level, or we end up slicing and dicing up the person's experience into these separate entities as if they're separate, when for the person they're being experienced concurrently.
Yeah.
So I think there's a few interesting things that come up around that.
Well, you know, I think, you know, there's lots of interesting things. So, you know, it's interesting you bring up PTSD and depression, because those are highly comorbid with each other. And there is, you know, a tremendous amount of debate in the PTSD literature as to whether or not, like, it's the same thing, or is it just two separate things? Who knows? And it doesn't really matter so much to the clients a lot of the time. GAD and depression is another one that, you know, is that rumination that you're experiencing, is that depression or is that GAD?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, there's a lot of times I'll look at someone's PCL5 score and I'll see that it's elevated, and then I'll go in and look and it's all the depression symptoms that are contained within the measure.
Yeah.
And so I'll say, you know, a lot of those fight or flight, hyperarousal symptoms have really been taken care of. It's this residual depression that is causing their PTSD score to remain elevated. In addition, I'm giving them depression measures, which are also high. So yeah, that's a really interesting idea, is like, are they actually separate things, or is it just part of the overall syndrome that can arise in the face of trauma?
Trauma is an interesting one to speak of, because you know, I do a lot of research, not specifically on trauma, but on something called moral injury. And, you know, a lot of this does, you know, a lot of the research on moral injury arose precisely because of some of these things, because of the high overlap between depression and PTSD, and because, you know, there wasn't, you know, our fear-based CBT models of PTSD, while they work fantastically well for those, you know, hyper arousal re-experiencing kinds of symptoms, they don't always, maybe with the exception of sort of more of the cognitively focused ones, like CPT, cognitive processing therapy, but you don't get a lot of the traction for the depressive piece, right? And those, you know, that's where you get a lot of the more, I would say, complex self-reflective emotions. You know, it's the guilt, the shame, the feelings of betrayal that don't necessarily work so well just to focus on doing, you know, gradual exposure, prolonged exposure, or imaginal exposure. The guilt remains, the shame remains.
I had Dr. Brett Litz, who did the adaptive disclosure protocol on the podcast just a little while ago. And he really seemed to feel that PTSD was largely a disorder of moral injury and betrayal. Like, he obviously acknowledged the other pillars of the, you know, the different symptom clusters, but really, really, I think I won't be able to do it justice, but he did such a nice job of outlining how central that sense of betrayal, internal or external, can be to the etiology, maintenance, and exacerbation of trauma over time. Really, really important issue that does not get, I think, a due attention.
It absolutely doesn't. You know, that's a whole, we're going to get derailed here if we start talking about moral injury, but it's, you know, it is a very important piece that I think does get overlooked a lot when we think about PTSD. So there's, again, you know, a nice example of, you know, we're trying to make as much sense as possible of a complex disorder where we're not really doing justice and capturing it in the same way. Now, some people like the new addition of the changes in cognition and emotion, and would argue that, contrary to Brett, that does help capture some of the betrayal and distress. And others argue that it doesn't, but, you know, I think it goes to show PTSD in particular is a really good example of how complex the diagnostic system is. Even just in terms of, you know, the first criteria for PTSD is like, you have to have experienced a traumatic event. And even just that one thing that sounds very simple to us, and straightforward. Okay, you have to have had a traumatic event. There's tremendous amount of debate, you know, of what constitutes a traumatic event. You know, and there's another term that is, you know, badly managed in the public sphere is trauma, and what trauma is, which is often mislabeled.
It's true. It's like, what is a trauma and who's decided that? And I mean, I think where I've seen that manifest the most is in workplace bullying situations, right? Where you've had someone in a really, really tough circumstance for, I'll make this up, like a year. And if you give them a PTSD measure or even do the assessment, you know, you might see a lot of symptoms that look very, very similar to what we would call PTSD, but that A1 criteria is not lighting up within the spirit of the way it was conceptualized necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are a lot of folks out there who are sort of, you know, they're left without a diagnostic home because of that. So we're unable to maybe assign this.
They end up in the NOS home.
Yeah, exactly. Which feels like a bit of a dumpster diagnosis. And I don't mean that sort of pejoratively, but it's like, hey, if it doesn't map on anything else, you've always got good old NOS to bail you out, which doesn't seem very intellectually rigorous. You know, it is what it is on some level.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in that particular instance, you could do the other one, the other dumpster one, which adjustment disorder, where you get all the symptoms, but it's just not quite, I probably, you know, again, so I'm getting my diagnostic hat, I would probably give that one as a stressor-related disorder, NOS, as opposed to adjustment disorder, but actually, does it really matter? At that point in time, You know, I know what the person's symptoms are. I know that they've experienced an event, whether or not it's whether diagnostically I consider it a trauma or not. I know that it was a distressing event for them regardless. And so again, that's another really great example. Like at the end of the day, at that point in time, my intervention probably wouldn't change that much, whether or not it was PTSD or an adjustment disorder or a trauma and stressor related disorder, NOS, I would still be doing some sort of prolonged exposure or something like that with them.
Oh, exactly. What I'll tell the client is like, I'm not able to communicate a diagnosis of PTSD to you from purely sort of almost like an academic lens, but guess what? We're going to treat this exactly the same as if it was PTSD.
It almost leaves us kind of sounding funny, doesn't it?
I'm sure the client's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Can you imagine a physician saying, well, you know, it's not cancer, but we're going to treat it exactly as though you have cancer.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it almost sounds, you know, it sounds ridiculous, really, when you actually think about it.
It does. Andrea, one thing I hope to touch on a little bit was just how little strengths or adaptation is emphasized in these diagnostic constructs. I'll give two examples off the top of my head. So we call borderline personality disorder a disorder, but often the coping reflects a really profound adaptation to very chaotic, traumatic circumstances. Not all the time, but a lot of the time, you know, the coping strategies that we see not working out in adult relationships are a function of, you know, surviving some very difficult circumstances. And I'll give one more in the sphere of depression. So one of the most reliable precipitants of depression is assuming a submissive position within an interpersonal dyad of some kind. And this is an evolutionary mechanism to avoid attack. So I'll give you an example. You have a boss who is a boss. They're in a higher position of power, but they're kind of an idiot. And you have a employee who's really sharp, but they're lower in the hierarchy. If they show that boss up in a meeting, the boss is going to go on the attack. So one of the ways that employee can insulate themselves from further attack is to like literally sort of shrink down, not challenge the person, and internalize this sense of being kind of dominated and become quite submissive and pleasing and all that kind of stuff. And that will reliably lead someone to become depressed over time. And so we call that depressive disorder when in fact the antecedent conditions reflect an adaptation to a very difficult set of circumstances. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, yes, the end state, we can call it a disorder or say there's a dysfunction built into it, but we don't often talk about the adaptation that disorder reflects to an initial set of circumstances. So I'm not sure if you had a thought on that, but it seems to me we don't do enough of talking about that, especially with clients, in terms of helping them understand how they have arrived in our office.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you bring that up for a lot of different things. I mean, if none of us experienced any social anxiety, think about how chaotic the world would be if people were just like, you know, saying whatever they wanted, doing whatever they wanted without any thought about how others would see them. You know, it might make for a very interesting world, but it would certainly be a stressful one. You know, I think there's, you know, in my own practice, I mean, that's absolutely a piece I almost always touch on when I do my talk on the function of emotions, you know, and you can tie a lot of that in, you know, with borderline personality. I do spend a lot of time at the front end with my clients once they've established a diagnosis and talking about, you know, how you develop that was actually adaptive for you in that particular instance. It was a way to protect yourself. And now it's, you know, now that situation is gone, it's not so helpful. So we need to learn to readapt. Whether that belongs in our diagnostic system or not, I'm unsure about that. But we don't have a diagnostic system to talk about people's strengths. So we don't focus enough on a lot on that. And you know, maybe we'd be better off to do some more of that sort of really focusing on also not only what are people coming to us with their problems, but also thinking about what are they coming to us, where do their strengths lie? We often might have a line about that. A person's very motivated to seek services, or, they've demonstrated strong coping strategies, but I don't think we do a formal assessment quite the same way as we would for the problems that they're coming with. I wonder whether we might get even better outcomes with our clients if we knew what strengths they were coming in with as well.
Right. Or a dimension of willingness, perhaps, right? A willingness to experience discomfort or to experience what's likely going to come up in therapy. Well, Andrea, I want to be respectful of your time. We've had a really good chat today. Looking at my notes, I didn't even get to probably more than 2/3 of them. There's just so much to talk about with respect to this topic. So maybe we'll have to pick it up again some other time. So yeah, thanks for coming by. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Take really good care.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.